My name is Shelley Bob, and the name of this session, I always have to look on the board for this, is Worship as Public Confession. We've been talking this week about the period of post-Weimar Republic in Germany and how the church, the confessing church, and other segments of the church said no to Hitler and what they had to go through to do that, and also setting the historical context. There's lots more to be said about that. And after looking at the syllabus for this week and then maybe a little bit for next week, I thought we could kind of step back from that just a little bit today and then pull it together for what it would mean for today as public worship. So for those of us who have been here partly or all the week, we may have insights from this period, or maybe you know this period too of Nazi Germany, but whether you do or not, I think we can still talk about this. So, and I wrote a lot of it down because I worked a couple of weeks ago on this, and I didn't want to lecture, so I thought if I wrote it down, we could take chunks and talk about it, if that would be okay. I think at a school, you know, with a bigger class, you just lecture, but it seems like this is more of an adult forum, and so I didn't know how to do this, so I just wrote what I studied and put together by myself, chunks on the board. So this is what this is, and I hope that's okay. Just as kind of a background, just from where we've been this week. In 1932, Hitler and the Nationalist Socialist Party gained the highest vote that was ever received in an election. And that was a result of a kind of feverish and violent campaign, which also was a result of 1931 when the cult of the Führer took hold. Now, do you remember what that campaign slogan was to get Hitler? Ultimately, in 1933, he becomes chancellor. But do you remember it wasn't really a campaign slogan, but actually it kind of was, I guess. It was fatherland, you know, the Aryan race, master superiority stuff. And that's what started to take hold. Well, here it is. I just went to another class and got too relaxed. We were outside. It was real pretty. There was another institute. I just found out about this in my reading about a month ago. In 1931, the Institute of Liturgical and Monastic Studies was founded in the Rhine Valley, in their equivalent of the Napa Valley in Germany. And this is a Benedictine monastery. Now, Benedictines are renowned for the rule of the Benedictines and keeping hours and a kind of beautifully, I think, regimented way of life. But we also like to think, especially as Lutherans, that they're sort of escaping, you know, into the monastery. But I want to read to you what this abbot said in 1931 when they started this monastery, because the Institute's theme was on the nature of religious art. And this is what he says. Religious art must, by its very nature, be social art. That is, it must grow out of the communion, faith, thought, experience, life, and not least of all, the common worship of the church. The individuality of the artistic personality cannot, therefore, be its norm. The norms of the community must come first. No matter how highly the individuality of the artist and the nation are valued, they must remain subordinate to the norms of the religious community. Now, that's a lot to swallow. Did you get any of that? What do you think he's saying?
Individualism comes after community.
Right. Do you think it's a criticism of Nazism at all? The cult of personality and nation, he says. Yeah.
No, it has to be.
Yeah. It is. It is. So you have an abbot in a Benedictine monastery who could turn his face to the wall, or I should say to the world, and shut the door on his monastery and do his thing. But he's saying that we have to engage in a public sphere as a community here in the Abbey. He becomes, for Roman Catholics and for some Protestants, and I can't remember his name, unfortunately. I had it written down in another thing that I forgot to bring. But he becomes, during this time period, his little call to action is very important because he talks about the community and what worship is. It isn't just a little thing where you go in and shut the door. It's a public act. And that's what I want to talk about today. What makes worship public and how important that is. Now, does anybody know how to say this word? Huh? I think it's liturgia, or it can be liturgia. It's Greek. And it means the discharge of public office. And this was during the Roman times, Hellenistic Roman times. It contributed to community, or another Greek word, koinonia. It means that your discharge of your public office, your liturgy, this is it, it contributed to the community, or koinonia. This is where, in fact, we get our word for coin. It means to share. Language adopted by the early Christian community for its own worship life was a political language. Liturgy in the context of community of Christ is not service to the state gods, but service to and for Jesus Christ. Now, try not to read this section. But what is this saying here? If in the old, this is just the state people, they said that this was the discharge of public office. This is just what you did in the public. And it contributed, though, to the whole community. But now we're looking at it just in a worship sense, and we say that liturgy and language adopted by the early Christian community for its own worship life was a political language. Liturgy in the context of community of Christ is not service to the state and state gods, but service to and for Jesus Christ. Now, what does that mean? This has implications not only for the early Christians or for the Nazi German period, but I also think it has drastic implications for us today in our worship.
Well, the Kyrie eleison is a confession that Jesus Christ is Lord, not Caesar, because the people were called upon to proclaim Caesar eleison.
Right. Good.
So it was making him the one who was both the center of our life instead of the state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It could have been perceived as a slap in the face of Caesar.
Or Hitler.
Yeah.
Whoever Caesar happens to be.
Yeah.
They say a Caesar by any other name. I had a book of Martin Luther Galatians in here. I'm too relaxed. Holden's starting to take hold. Okay. So, now how could this also be dangerous or be... Do you see any danger in this at all?
Is that coming out of that monastery? Where was that?
No, this is kind of... I wanted just to show Jan how these two things were going on at the same time.
But I think
that this statement that I've cooked up can come out of what this guy was saying here.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. I made the leap. How could this be dangerous?
You mean dangerous to the Christian church or dangerous for the Christian church?
Either way, because I think they're both...
Well, when we talked about earlier about the way Hitler was using the churches...
Right.
how can he use if they believe this? He can't use it.
No, no. And why can't they, Jan?
Because this says that the liturgy in context of the community of Christ doesn't serve the state or state gods, but
right.
serves Christ. And
right.
that's just the opposite of what he was trying to do.
That's
he was
right.
trying to get the church to serve state and its gods.
Good. Good. Now, on one hand, does this seem like a big deal statement? I mean, you're probably thinking, well, this, you know, this isn't a big deal. Why is it a big deal statement?
It's against everything else that Hitler's promoted.
Yeah, it is. And can you bank it up to now? What's going on in the world now at all?
Well, it's the same thing we're doing now.
Can you?
I don't know what you're asking.
No, you're doing great. Huh?
It's so obvious.
Yeah, yeah. I just mean to spell it, to spin it out a little bit more, even though it's obvious.
This is.
So this is as important a statement during the post-Weimar Republic as it is today. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay.
And the nationalism you're trying to have, and the still wanting the flag and the church and the whole bit.
Right.
Would be against that.
Good, good. All right. I know it seems kind of obvious, but it isn't to some pastors, and I also think to many congregations. And one thing I came on the ferry to Holden thinking was that some of the most obvious things that I'm studying and trying to put together seem to be very distant in many congregational councils that I work with, and people who just are the normal Joes and Josephines who have their shoes and their foots and sitting in the pew. I would like to see a recovery of this, and I think there are many people who share that too. Does service of liturgy extend to the broader society, or is it directed just to the koinonia, the worshiping community? What would you say about that? My last church, the church council, had a definite opinion on this.
It has to be to the broader community. You know, you have a choice.
But it is.
I think it has.
It depends on what you're talking about.
Doesn't it first have to be for the community, for the koinonia, and then it extends beyond that?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't know what we're doing in the service liturgy,
good.
How can we possibly share it with the broader society?
So we have to learn the language first to be able to hit the streets with it?
But if what we do in liturgy and worship never leaves the sanctuary,
mm-hmm.
then what good is it?
Good. Good.
But, you know, I think that's a fiction. You know, I'm part of a small church that's very socially active, and we've got a minister who, you know, goes to jail for his beliefs and then comes back.
Just don't pay him then.
That's right. They don't pay.
He said it's.
People say that, but I think I still think it's a fiction because the community itself has a vested interest in maintaining itself, and you know there are real efforts to reach out. By individual members of the community or perhaps groups in the community, but there's also people in the congregation that just want to be together in a community of faith, you know, on Sunday, and they're not fired up enough to, you know, to do the rest of it, or maybe they move in and out, you know, it's more of a dance, mm-hmm. sometimes you have to make yourself and do something, and like I remember us going out and parading during the Gulf War, you know, between mm-hmm. the Catholic Cathedral and whatever else, other cathedral. There's two of them and they're conveniently apart, so we went from one to the other, you know, the Episcopal.
Against,
the Episcopal Cathedral on one side and the Catholic mm-hmm. one on the other. That's something that's fairly easy. Going out and working with the lifers is not so easy, you know, which is what some people in our congregation, they go to prison one day a week and do so. Anyway, the short of it is there are people that are highly committed to social ministry, and there are the people who are not, or who find their role within the community, you know, youth education or rolling paper, you know, or something like that, you know, for they roll newspaper for florists and things like that, and they find joy in that. Mm-hmm. You know, so,
what were you going to say that you had?
I think that that's valid, but I also think that the way we live our lives can't be discounted. And so that people who are not involved in a social ministry as that's defined can't be discounted for what they do do. And one of the things that I heard that Walt Bowman brought up, was it last night you were telling me about this? The Jewish community, when it worships publicly, you know that it worships because the people worship because you see them walking to and from church or synagogue, and that's public. And I wouldn't want to discount those tiny little things that are ever so important because I think that's part of witness.
Good. I heard one of the a guy talk on witness once who said, on Sunday mornings these days, pulling your car out of the driveway and getting dressed up and getting in it and going to church is a witness right there. I mean, and getting your kids in it. Oh, yes, you're going to go. Yeah, good. Well, that's just a little question, but is worship itself, do you think, a political act at all? Does it have any political action to it?
Oh, I think it's got to be, because if you're talking about sharing, if you're talking about caring, you know, it's going to all be involved in how you act politically too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people come to our church interview. Sometimes it gets controversial, and they come and interview church members and say, what is your feeling about so-and-so, and then you get your name in the paper. That happened to me once. And so that's political. And also, how much a pastor spends time deviating from the text, you know, I mean, getting into political things. But a really good pastor can do that within the, doesn't have to really get outside of the text.
I wouldn't say that's deviation sometimes. I would say that's following Christ's.
Yeah, but I mean, I really object to that.
Invitation.
I mean, to somebody going political in the pulpit, you know, to me. To me, he's gotta be in there to preach the gospel, and if he has a few sidelines to go alongside with it, great. You know, some Sundays that'll be okay. But you know, I don't think that's totally the answer.
I think also just the very fact that the church makes a confession is a political act.
I do too.
We confess that Jesus is Lord.
Right.
Therefore, that's what's most important in our lives, not whatever's going on in the broader society,
good.
Not whatever's going on in the political world, but our confession of Christ is a political act.
I think so, too.
The prayer life of the church, too. And the last thing I do before I leave for church on Sunday morning is get the newspaper and see if something happened that needs addressing in the prayers. You know, and it's not. That's usually not anything that has to do with the church or the world and politics.
Yeah, that's true. We have a dialogue about prayers in the church. I was just thinking about that. Like, when I was asked to do prayers, it was like Earth Day or something, and that's political, you know. And I think that happens every week, really, that people think about, like you said, think about their. What to include in the prayers.
Yeah. I think, though, by the church's very prayer and act of confession, that it is a political act as well. Whether you name whatever or what's happening in Congress for the day or any action that was taken, the fact that you say, Jesus Christ is Lord and my Lord.
The there is something the church believes.
Yeah.
They're not just there saying, well, whatever you want.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And next week, we're going to look at confessionals. Well, actually, it was a declaration. It really wasn't a confession. During the Nazi period that said just that. All it did was, it started out with scripture verses and then just say, by its very declaration, it was a political statement. I guess today, more than come to big conclusions, I just want us to think about some of the things we've been talking about this week, and I needed to do this too. For Luther, which is where I ground, I can't help it. I've come to terms with it, you know, I just can't help it, much of my thinking. I guess we are. Michael, are you Lutheran? Hmm? Are you Lutheran? Mm-hmm. Well.
Luther was a very political animal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. If he almost got killed
that guy
many times for it. Sure.
Which way his bread was buttered.
Yeah. Before Luther, the proclamation of gospel and administration of the sacraments, which is found in the Augsburg Confession, number 7, we read that earlier this week, is sharply and clearly distinguished from political activity to preserve distinction between the righteousness of faith and civic righteousness. Does that make sense to you? That's kind of a mouthful, isn't it? May I read something from Galatians from Luther that may be better than what I tried to put together? This is from one of my favorite Luther works, his lectures on Galatians. For Christians do not become righteous by doing righteous works. But once they have been justified by faith in Christ, they do righteous works. In civil life, the situation is different. Here one becomes a doer on the basis of deeds, just as one becomes a lutenist by often playing the lute, as Aristotle says. But in theology, one does not become a doer on the basis of the works of the law. First, there must be the doer, and then the deeds follow. And then he goes on to argue what the sophists say. It's kind of a complicated argument. But there's an irony in this statement and something that I'd like to talk about today because this is part of what I'm working on. To have good deeds done, I was just going to say this, but it's such a weird statement I thought I'd write it up. To have good deeds done, then you must preserve good doers. I mean, right? You got to make them. But good doers are not produced by attending to their doing, because that would their own doing, because that would be unrighteousness. True righteousness and the deeds that flow from it can only be produced by God. Politics must be kept out of worship if true righteousness is to prevail. Now, I'm not saying I agree with this statement. I'm just saying for the sake of an academic argument that this could be what would be called an ironic statement. Does that make sense to you? Do you understand?
I have tried to explain this many times to a Calvinist, and they don't understand.
Well, taking off what Luther says in Galatians, I think there is an irony in it.
That is a hard thing to understand about Luther.
Well, it is, and that we're going to, I hope, talk it through, but does that make sense?
What's the point?
Yeah. Huh?
What's the point?
The point of what?
What is that trying to say? Okay, you can't create.
Start out with if.
I don't know how to do
it. If you're the doer, you will become self-righteous like the Pharisees.
Right.
If you have true righteousness, and then it's good from only being produced by God. In other words, what you start with the cross and with the resurrection, and then what follows, or what's produced by God, is the good deeds.
Right.
Now, but I don't know, the politics must be kept out of, I don't know where that's coming from.
Yeah.
And that sense doesn't make sense with the rest of the thing.
Well, to me, it does.
Okay.
This is, and this is taking a leap, trying to deal with some of this political stuff. Now, don't look at the are we okay up to the political stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, fine. Now, then I'm saying, because of this irony, one could possibly say, I'm not saying this is true, but one could possibly say, politics must be kept out of worship if true righteousness is to prevail.
Oh, I see, yes.
But that's saying we don't also have to instruct people, whether it's political life or family life, give them some instruction on how to live, how to do the doing.
Right, and I'm just saying that sometimes I think this happens, and I don't think it's good.
Yeah.
Now I'll come clean. Okay, just keep going. Gerald Strauss, in a little book called Luther's House of Learning, I don't know if it was, I can't remember when it was published, but he said, it's difficult or tough to form a motivational link between faith's inner passive spirit, you know, the faith that comes to us and we receive and it's given to us, we don't cook it up on our own. Luther's third explanation to the a third article of the Creed, I believe I cannot by my own understanding or effort believe in Jesus Christ my Lord or come from. The passive spirit and the external practices needed to form a public community of virtue. Why should, he says, kind of with tongue in his cheek, Christians engage in the discipline of moral education when such efforts could not affect the central transformation of the self from peccator to justus, or from sinner to justified? Does that make sense?
I understand it. Do you mean to
this is harder, yeah. I mean, why, he says that one of the paralytic things that happen to the church when we do the two kingdom and we don't engage in a dialogue and we say that we don't have to do anything anyway because God is the doer, then why should Christians engage in the discipline of moral education when such efforts could be could not affect the central transformation of the self from sinner to justus, to justified anyway? In other words, why bother to do it if you can't do it yourself anyway? This is often quoted around congregational council tables, not this exact quote. but it's often said, we live by grace, we live by faith. Then, so why bother with moral education?
The temptation of Luther's being quietistic.
Right, right. But this is a dangerous thing, and it has resulted in Lutheran paralysis to become involved in issues of political involvement, or I think even ethical situations.
But because we know the end of the story doesn't mean that we've read the book. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us to get the beginning of the book. This is Walt Roman's stuff. I'm not going to take credit for this. It's up to us to get from chapter one to the end of the story.
It is.
So we've been given the end of the story. We know what the end of the story is, but it would be irresponsible to not read the book and to teach the book and to share the book.
Right. One of my teachers used to say about this as an answer to this, that if you've got a really nice car in the garage, you drive it, don't you? I mean, you use it. You know how to use it, and you know it. You can trust it, and you know it's going to take you places, but you just don't let it sit there. In other words, you know what it can do for you and for maybe helping somebody else. It's the end of the book. It's just a different twist on it, I think. I don't agree with this, but I do think we need to look at it to see how damaging that it can be. And this is still afoot. It's afoot. It's very popular. In fact, my friend just joined a major church, Lutheran church, in York, Pennsylvania, which is a real bastion of Lutheran territory, very near Gettysburg Seminary. Literally, I think I said last night, and I truly mean it, within every 5 or 6 miles there's a Lutheran church. Some are small, but some are quite big. And she went in to talk to the pastor before, she didn't end up joining, before she was going to join, just to see where he lined up on things and, you know, how he viewed ministry. And she's not a person that would be out to get somebody, but she takes her faith very seriously. And he said he fully believed in the Lutheran quietism movement and quoted, in fact, Strauss, and said how he thought that, I mean, he agreed with this. She didn't join that. They were able to do that. American life is pluralistic. This is a hot word. It is not the melting pot that some historians and sociologists like to talk about in the 30s and 40s and 50s. There are wide gaps between the wealthy and the poor. And a book that I didn't order, but I just find very good about talking about this, put up on the University of Chicago Press from 1987, is William Julius Wilson's The Truly Disadvantaged, The Inner City, The Underclass, and Public Policy. This is a very helpful book. Churches now are pluralistic too, and where can we think of some examples, even in our own ELCA, where that's true? Where we're having to deal with different notions of issues.
Our own congregation has opened up to gays and lesbians as members, and that's a real problem.
Is that a pluralistic?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think that would be a gender pluralism. A sexuality pluralism. Excuse me.
Our pastor has now been blackballed or called to other places because he has accepted people.
Not accepted, or they're just
ordained.
Just to be members.
Really? Well, we went through that, and all the old timers that protested either left or got reconciled to it.
Yeah, well, the parish itself is fine. It has to do with the area churches and the area of the bishopric.
Oh, I guess it's different in different areas.
They're learning. It's a real witness, but it's still.
Okay, that's a good. Yeah, it is. It is, and that's a good example. That's a good example. Anybody else? This goes into a lot of different pockets in church life, and also with our own national different statements that the church, I think, right now is struggling with over issues.
Oh, especially I think divorces are still a problem, and acceptance in the church.
Yeah. Divorces.
We are also a mixed congregation, black and white, and that's also a problem.
Okay.
Most of the people who jumped into that have already left.
Good.
But there are people out there yet who are, you know, Lutherans who have difficulties with that. What else?
Well, that pretty well. I mean, there are a million. Does anybody else want to?
No, on kind of a reverse side, we have a congregation that worships at the 8:30 hour, which is a very conservative. Where they are is kind of a old conservative line, and is it wrong to take away from them a liturgy that they're very comfortable with?
So there's liturgical pluralism too. Absolutely, yeah. My parents' church in Dayton, Ohio, they have three very separate, different services for different populations, and my mother says, depending on her mood for the day, where she likes to worship, and my dad. So, there's a pluralism within the unity of this one church, too, that seems to work okay. Mm-hmm. But.
And how many churches are truly accessible to everyone?
Good. Accessibility is a huge issue. I have a rather bleeding story from my last parish, but I we'll get into all that, but it I never knew it would be such a pluralistic issue. I just thought this is something like you take your kid out of the line of a car that's coming, you make your church accessible. I heard lines like, if they want to come to church bad enough, they'll crawl up the steps. Just because they're baptized doesn't mean that they have to come to church. They can have church downstairs and we can get a video camera, because we were on it was an old congregation, a second floor sanctuary, so they can see it, and then we'll come down and visit them during the offering. There were incredible stories.
Or we will carry them up the stairs.
Well, that was another one.
That's, you know, yeah. We don't need to do that. We'll just carry them in. And,
right.
You know, we'll carry the furniture in, and we'll carry the people in.
Yeah, yeah. And then they got this mechanized chair that was really kind of,
I got lost and disabled.
Yeah.
Persons who cannot,
yeah,
who cannot walk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who need accessibility. Yeah.
We bled over this issue, and I would go home furious that, I mean, I thought this shouldn't even be and we were a church that had $500,000 in the bank, not doing a thing and no debts, and they wouldn't spend it on an elevator.
The irony is, if you did any little building project, the building would be, or you'd have to do it, at least where we are.
I know that, the labor and interest, the L and I know all that, but that's why they didn't want to make any changes. Well, I decided it was time to go back to school. That and after the Gulf War, that's a really good example. And one, like I just said, I didn't think it would be an issue. I had concerns about it, but other people did too, but it was incredible. I think it had maybe some power things were happening. Mm-hmm.
There are a few congregations out there too who have not yet gone to the green room.
Yes.
Less any contemporary service of any sort. You know.
Yes, there
are. They're still back in the old, was it called, Red Book?
Yeah, we the Red Book.
The SBH service book.
But there are congregations who took it.
Yeah, yeah.
And are still.
Yeah, that's right. There are that. So we have pluralism within our congregations. So how can and does worship address those things within a congregation? How? Let's just take, because I think it's hard to be of divided minds, maybe in this group, about the accessibility issue.
Yeah.
You know, I hope we could all say churches should be accessible completely. How could worship possibly address this issue? And we tried to, but I want to hear how could worship address this issue?
Education. You got to work through it with people too, mm-hmm. not impose.
Right.
You know, you simply have to say, well, now this is an issue. Let's work with it. Let's find out what our best path is or something. Mm-hmm. Just work together with a group of people.
Good.
Tell you about
good.
Come to some kind of an education.
Yeah.
Looking into it seriously.
Could you possibly use scripture in that, Jan?
Oh, well, of course.
Good. I think we need to say that. I mean, it's kind of a, I know that. But, right, but I think using the church's treasury scripture is really important for those things, too.
This morning, Mark Schwain's talked about the Lord's Supper, and he made some interesting observations about inclusivity and how Jesus recognized that there were those among them who who were going to betray him,
mm-hmm.
and yet he didn't exclude them.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a verse that, a part of scripture that could be used.
That's good.
Sure.
Yeah, that could be. There's nothing better than hitting somebody with their own stuff. Let's just go down to this because we're running out of time. I think this is kind of my own proposal, but it's just an idea. Recovery of an authentic public voice and critical appropriation of religious tradition must go hand in hand. So I think we need to have this voice be authentic, in other words, be scriptural and authentic, But there also has to be, along with it, the appropriation of religious traditions that we carry. And for me, that's scripture and the confessions. And they have to go hand in hand, though. I can't just do this without this. And if I do this without being authentic, it's not going to work either. Who can we think of that might be some really popular role models that do this, that or have done this really well?
Tradition. You know, the Anglicans and the appropriation of religious tradition, they still stick to the service book as a must.
That's right, they do, yeah. They have one foot anchored pretty hard in that, okay. Can you think of any people that do that, have done that? I think Martin Luther King did that. He was an authentic public voice, Martin Luther King Jr. But he also used his own tradition, his religious traditions to do that. He didn't step out of his own traditions at all. He used them, and I think that's one reason it works so well. I think Vatican II, in a way, did this as well. That one could be debated, but I'm going to say that it said, try to find an authentic public voice, but also use the traditions. And I think that's what made Vatican II cook the way it did. I have four proposals for how we can possibly do this. In some ways, we're going to look at these and say, well, yeah, big deal, of course. But I think they're very important. And I think if church councils and retreats came to terms with these, maybe we would be doing this a little bit better. The church must rediscover the link between church and catechesis, or teaching, and worship and education. I think those go hand in hand. It was interesting, Jan, the first thing I said, how would you do this? And the first thing you said was you'd teach, but also you'd incorporate it in worship. Churches can be model for public life of communities, which is pluralistic citizenship, in which pluralistic citizenship is possible. You can have unity in the midst of diversity. I don't think we all have to be the same at St. Mark's Lutheran and blah, 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 you know. There can be different, and we can be a model for that and how we do it and discern and make decisions, yet still can say together the creed. I think that they need to be a community of hope. I think that authentic public voices and following your tradition to be able to speak to the world has to be a community of hope. And this last one I feel perhaps strongest about. We should be a community that preaches Christ crucified and resurrected and follows Luther's 1518 Heidelberg Disputations, the theology of the cross. There is a recovery of this, I think, would do more than anything else. I have some little symbols there, but I'm trusting you all can recognize what they are. Any comments about this? Does this sound way out in left field, or does it make sense? It's a very simple proposal, but I've been in the parish for 12 years, and now I've been a student for 3, and I've been trying to put these two things together, and this is kind of what I see.
I think it's the outline for a really good paper that ought to be published.
Well, maybe you'll do that. Or maybe I will.
Maybe I'll read it.
You know, I have to go to a conference in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. Isn't that a shame? In August. Doesn't that sound delightful? And I might do this. This is what I might propose.
Yeah, I'd encourage